Iran criticizes the European signatories to the nuclear deal for their failure to act on the U.S. violations of the accord. Vote counting is underway in Iraq for the Sunday early parliamentary elections. Officials put the voter turnout at 41%. The Algerian president says his country is not a French colony any longer, demanding total respect from France. I'm Behrouz Najafi. It's good to have you with us. Now, top story this hour, Iran blaming Europe's inaction for U.S. withdrawal from the 2015 nuclear deal and its violation of the landmark international accord. Iranian Foreign Ministry spokesman made a comment during its weekly presser. Said Khatibzadeh said that the European signatories to the Iran nuclear deal were passive observers of Washington's violations on audacity. Khatibzadeh underlined that the signatories must reassure Tehran that such violations would never happen again. He also accused Germany of failing to implement a series of commitments under the 2015 deal. The Iran official was reacting to statements by outgoing German Chancellor Angela Merkel, who during her visit to Israel called on Iran to return to negotiations. Iran has already made it clear it's reviewing technical details to make sure all parties fully implement the agreements. Now from Damascus, I'm joined by Tim Anderson, director of the Center for Counter-Hegemonic Studies. Good to have you with us, Tim. So why should Iran go back to negotiations if there is nothing going to get out of it like previously? Of course, Iran has announced that it is getting ready to do that. I don't understand why countries like Germany that were just passive onlookers, as the Iranian Foreign Ministry spokesman put it, they did nothing, and then they expect Iran to go back. Talk for the sake of talks is good for nothing, is it?
Yes, I think what we've been seeing for the last year really is a dance, a type of charade to see who's going to wear the blame for the failure of this program, which after all, the nuclear deal was really always a device, not about nuclear energy, it's about a device to subjugate Iran and subject it to espionage effectively. But because the deal was endorsed by the UN Security Council, and as you say, neither the Europeans or the US really lived up to their part of the deal, there is this type of charade to see who is going to wear the blame there. I suppose this may carry on for some time.
Yeah, apart from the blame game, what do you think, Tim, Iran can do? How can Iran get assurances that the same scenario is not going to be repeated again?
Well, I don't think it will be repeated again because, of course, Russia and China were part of the deal, and they have a totally different position now. I mean, the deal when it was formulated a decade ago. The Europeans have demonstrated they don't have the political will to break from the US, even though they disagreed with the Trump position. Biden has effectively carried on the Trump idea of maximum pressure. It's simply about trying to leverage against Iran's role in the region entirely. We know that because they've tried to associate other issues like missile technology with the deal, basically. And there's really, the Biden administration has shown that it can't really back down and say, okay, we'll go back to the original deal. They've never taken that position in the last 18 months of the Biden administration. So I think Iran just has to stick to its guns, more or less. It complied with the deal for the first 12 months or so. Then when there was no reciprocation, Iran said, okay, we're going to wind back the our obligations under the deal.
Great, thanks for that. Tim Anderson, director of the Center for Counter-Hegemonic Studies in Damascus. Now, vote counting is underway for the Sunday early parliamentary elections in Iraq. The Electoral Commission has put the turnout at 41%, lower than the last election held in 2018. Some 25 million people were eligible to cast their ballots for a 329-seat legislature. Around 3,500 candidates are in the fray, and this is Iraq's fifth parliamentary election since the ouster of former dictator Saddam Hussein in 2003. Sunday vote was called 1 year earlier than it was scheduled in response to the 2019 street protests over economic woes and high-level corruption. Our correspondent in Baghdad, Wassam Bahrani, joined us a short while ago with some details on the vote counting process. following the parliamentary elections in Iraq.
These are preliminary results that have been announced. 41%, which is, some would say that's a low turnout, and some would say that's a good turnout considering the circumstances that the country is facing, security threats and issues and the such. In any case, I think questions will be asked because not a lot is expected to change in Parliament. These are according to party officials and candidates who received the results of the new electronic system. They received the results, a list of the results, so they have an idea as to how the results would have unfolded. And we're expecting an official announcement as to the exact turnout, and which is expected to remain at that number, even lower than 2018, where 44.5% had turned out. And we're also at around 3 p.m. expecting a general announcement of, you know, who won how many seats.
A huge fire has broken out at an oil facility in southern Lebanon following a reported blast. A thick column of black smoke can be seen billowing from the fuel storage tank in the Zahrani facility. Firefighters have rushed to the site located near the city of Sidon to prevent the blaze from spreading to other tanks. The army has also evacuated the area amid fears that the fire may cause explosions. It's not clear what caused the blaze, and the incident comes as Lebanon has been grappling for months with an acute fuel shortage. Algerian president says that the return of Algiers' ambassador to France is conditional on total respect for his country. Abdelmadjid Tebboune says Algeria is not a French colony any longer, adding that history should not be falsified. Algeria recalled its envoy to Paris last week, citing comments attributed to French President Macron that Algeria's rulers had rewritten the history of its colonization based on a hatred of France. The following day, Algeria banned French military planes from its airspace amid the tensions with Paris. Political commentator Abiyomi Azakiwa says that France's policies toward African countries, including Algeria, are still rooted in colonialism.
It's not surprising. It follows a pattern of many people on the African continent that have been criticizing France for the continuation of its legacy of colonialism and enslavement. Just a few weeks ago, Macron had a meeting with some Algerians who had fought alongside of Paris during the war for national liberation in Algeria during the 1950s and 60s. And that's where those statements that you quoted earlier were made. So he's suggesting that there was really no Algerian nation prior to the advent of French colonialism way back in 1830. They colonized the country for over 130 years. And during the war between 1954 and 1962, over a million Algerians were killed as a result of the French colonial forces. They have never apologized. They've never offered to pay reparations. And it adds insult to injury for them to suggest that they had committed no colonial crimes in Algeria.
Now over to Chile, where white police have clashed with protesters during a rally by the indigenous Mapuche community. Riot police used tear gas and water cannon to disperse the rallyers. Authorities said that a woman died, 17 police officers were injured, and 10 protesters were arrested during the clashes. Around 1,000 activists marched in the center of Santiago, demanding autonomy for the Mapuche. The Chilean state has long been accused of discrimination against the Mapuche people, the country's largest indigenous group. The community controlled vast areas of Chile centuries ago, but has since been marginalized. Over 100,000 Poles have demonstrated in support of European Union membership after a court ruled that the Polish constitution overrides some EU laws. People rallied in some 100 towns and cities, as well as in the capital Warsaw, warning against another Brexit. The recent ruling raised concerns that it could propel Poland into an exit from the bloc. Donald Tusk, leader of the country's biggest opposition party, Civic Platform, and ex-president of the European Council, called on Poles to protest the ruling. The European Commission says that the changes have undermined judicial independence and opened up the courts to political interference. In an escalation of row between Poland and the EU, Polish judges ruled that national law has primacy over European rules. A huge crowd had gathered in the Belgian capital Brussels, demanding that world leaders take tougher action to fight climate change. Many of the ralliers accused EU leaders of dithering over the crisis, Jerome Hughes reports.
Tens of thousands took to the streets of Brussels on Sunday to try and apply pressure on heads of governments in the EU to be more decisive when it comes to climate change. It was the biggest protest of its kind since the coronavirus pandemic took hold in the 27-nation bloc.
There's a sense of urgency between young people, elderly people. We are the grandparents for the climate.
There is no plan B. Actually, it's this moment is the moment to change our habits.
You are young and you change the world. And I'm here for change the world.
Droughts, fires, tornadoes and floods hit regions around the world during the summer. And scientists say fuel emissions are to blame. There was plenty of criticism handed out to EU leaders during the Brussels event.
Our politicians are not... don't seem to be hearing what we say.
Since the first marches, the political language has changed a bit, but not enough at all.
All these people in the street are necessary to tell politicians, be ambitious, because we're going to vote for you.
They're waiting too long. We have to agree with a lot of different countries.
Campaigners warn there will not be many more next generations if greater impetus is not applied to dealing with the crisis, particularly from big carbon emitters like the US, EU and China.
We have to work together, Europe and the whole world.
We should have been here more people to show that we all want to change.
With my friends, we're studying in science. We want to fight and change the consequences of the past.
Referring to oil and gas, they chanted, "Keep it in the ground." Doing so might be unjustifiable in the context of economic growth and social inclusion, many analysts argue.
That's because for decades, the richest countries have become richer through the use of fossil fuels. Now developing nations are being told not to do the same by world powers. These poorer countries are saying, fair enough, but you must compensate us financially.
World leaders are being urged to tackle this very issue head on when they meet at the end of the month for a 12-day UN climate change summit in Glasgow, Scotland. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
The volcano on the Spanish island of La Palma keeps spewing molten rock 3 weeks after eruption. Blocks of red hot lava as large as three story buildings rolled down a hillside on Sunday while a series of tremors shook the ground. There were 21 seismic movements, with the largest measuring 3.8. On Saturday, there was a partial cone collapse near the volcano's emission vent, which caused the release of large blocks of molten rock. Lava has destroyed nearly 1,200 buildings since the eruption on September 19th. 6,000 people have been evacuated from their homes on La Palma, which has around 83,000 inhabitants. With that, we come to the end of this news broadcast from Tehran. Thank you.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran.
In the limelight. Fears that the United Kingdom is heading for a trade war with the European Union have been fueled by strong indications from the British government that proposals to be unveiled in Brussels on Wednesday, 13th of October, over Brexit arrangements do not go far enough. The Brexit Minister, Lord Frost, will use a speech in Portugal on Tuesday, 12th of October, to say that the scrapping its prohibition on British sausages to resolve the dispute over the Northern Ireland Protocol do not meet Britain and Unionist demands. The article you're about to hear has been written by The Guardian's Brexit correspondent Lisa O'Carroll. The piece is titled, Trade War Looms as UK Set to Spurn EU Offer on Northern Ireland. Fears that Britain is heading for a trade war with the European Union have been fueled by strong indications from the British government that proposals to be unveiled in Brussels on Wednesday, 13th of October, over Brexit arrangements do not go far enough. The Brexit Minister, Lord Frost, will use a speech in Portugal on Tuesday, 12th of October, to say that scrapping its prohibition on British sausages to resolve the dispute over the Northern Ireland Protocol do not meet Britain and Unionist demands. The peer will call for significant changes to the post-Brexit agreement he negotiated, including over the role of the European Court of Justice, something the European Union is highly unlikely to concede to. Without new arrangements in this area, the protocol will never have the support it needs to survive, he will warn on the eve of a significant move by the European Union to resolve the row. Meanwhile, Ireland's Foreign Minister Simon Coveney reacted with incredulity at Britain's red line and its timing just days before what he said was a serious offer from the European Union. Simon Coveney tweeted, EU working seriously to resolve practical issues with implementation of protocol. So British government creates a new red line barrier to progress that they know the European Union can't move on. Are we surprised? But the real question is, does the British government actually want an agreed way forward or a further breakdown in relations? The European Union's Brexit Commissioner, Maroš Šefčovič, will table four papers on Wednesday on the subject of how the Northern Ireland Protocol can be improved, which he has described as very far-reaching. Included will be a proposed national identity exemption for British sausages from the EU's prohibition on prepared meat from a third country, sources have confirmed. But Mojtaba Rahman, the managing director of the Eurasia Group consultancy, warned in a note to clients on Saturday that the absence of concessions on the European Court of Justice will give Lord Frost the justification for triggering Article 16, the mechanism for putting the Northern Ireland Protocol into formal dispute process or putting it into abeyance by disapplying the arrangements altogether. There is a huge amount of cynicism in the European Union about what the British government's actual objectives are. Is it to fix substantive issues in Northern Ireland, or is it to keep an ideological fight with the European Union rolling because it serves certain sections of the Tory party, said Rahman. The French president and the German chancellor And the European Commission president cannot wake up every single day to a new argument with Boris Johnson. At some point, they need to send a stronger, simpler message. The use of a termination clause within the trade and cooperation agreement itself can be triggered unilaterally and would fully suspend the zero-tariff, zero-quota trade deal between the two sides. This cross-retaliation mechanism, allowing trade penalties for breaches of the withdrawal agreement, was agreed by both sides, but others think the European Union will not be so keen to go nuclear. Catherine Barnard, professor of European Union law at University of Cambridge, believes short, sharp shocks in the form of tariffs on iconic British products such as Scottish whisky or Scottish salmon are more likely. She also said that the European Court of Justice is not a significant issue in relation to the trade of goods. Its annual report cites just 24 cases relating to customs union laws currently pending, among more than 1,045 cases in total. Lord Frost also told delegates at the Conservative Party conference last week that the rules required the European Union to be proportionate, but said he still hoped to come out of negotiations with a fresh deal. Retaliatory measures are unlikely until next year, with the European Union expected to respond with infringement and legal proceedings as its first response to any suspension of the Northern Ireland Protocol by Britain. Northern Ireland Protocol, designed to avoid a hard border between the United Kingdom and the single market operating in the Republic of Ireland, placed the border in the Irish Sea, enraging unionists in Northern Ireland who see checks on goods coming into Northern Ireland from Britain as an attack on the integrity of the UK and their British identity. The European Union is expected to propose eliminating checks on goods destined to remain in Northern Ireland, with checks only on those products that are intended for sale in the Irish Republic. Both sides have said they expect to go into a period of intense negotiations, which Lord Frost put at 3 weeks after the EU's response to the UK's demands are published on Wednesday. But one school of thought is that Frost and the Home Secretary Priti Patel are being used to keep the Brexit pot boiling to show how the UK is sticking up against EU bullies. Others think the fight over Northern Ireland Protocol is more fundamental. One former Downing Street official said he had been told Boris Johnson was going round telling people he had been misled over the protocol and was determined it would have to be rewritten. Frost will say on Tuesday that Britain-EU relationship is under strain, but if the two sides can put the protocol on a durable footing, we have the opportunity to move past the difficulties of the past year.
Now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Hello and welcome to Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashimi. Thanks so much for being with us. Well, millions of British people could fall into fuel poverty this year. That means that some would have to cut back on the basics in order to be able to heat their homes. This gas shortage and price rise follow empty pumps at petrol stations, where due to a shortage of truck drivers, Brits have had to wait in long lines to fill up their cars. Even the government has brought the army in to drive trucks to try to fill the supply gap. But all of it seems to be pointing to mismanagement by the government. Stay with us as we take a look at it all on this spotlight. Let's cross over to London, start off with Amina Taylor. Amina, give us your take. What's going on?
Yeah, this is shaping up to what some commentators are saying is a return to the bad old days. The old phrase, winter of discontent, being thrown around here, because not only did you have those rather unsavory scenes of empty fuel pumps and consumers queuing up to get a little bit of petrol for their cars if there was any to go around, you're also combating and trying to balance that with issues in the breakdown of the fuel supply train. You're also looking at a situation where energy firms, some of the smaller ones who were able to perform and provide a little bit more competition in the market, going bust. So on one hand, you have fuel issues at the pumps, and at the other hand, you're looking at fuel issues for the homes. And as always, you have the most vulnerable consumers having to deal with some very real crisis-making decisions about whether or not they can put food in their bellies, food in the bellies of their children, or perhaps provide fuel for their vehicles to get to work, to get to some crucial jobs, or to heat their homes. So I think many of those who would have listened to the Prime Minister's speech a little bit earlier in the week will be wondering what parallel universe Boris Johnson is living in, when so many of his subjects will be wondering just how they will make it through the winter this month. And unfortunately, I believe this is just the beginning of things to come, and unfortunately not the beginning of the end.
Well, I mean, just staying with you briefly, because the Prime Minister has tried to show a brave face and said that things are getting better. I mean, your assessment of people's reaction on the ground, I mean, do they believe this? Do they believe that things are getting better, or are they feel that it's getting worse?
Well, they don't have to believe if it's getting better or worse. They just have to look at the realities on the ground. And even though one might think that the Conservatives would be a bit further behind in the poll, they're not, which tells its own story. But it's also about when this starts to bite a little bit more, because even if individuals didn't have the major issues with their vehicles, maybe these individuals will not be affected by the rise in domestic fuel prices just yet for their homes. When some of these price caps go and people are renegotiating the cost of energy to their homes, they'll really start to feel that bump. And we're talking about hundreds of pounds for even the most conservative estimate here. So unfortunately, it's not a matter of whether they have an impression of what's going on. The reality will soon come to bite, unfortunately. And it's those lower to middle income families that will feel it the most. £400 is nothing to somebody who's earning a lot of money. But believe me, when you're already counting every penny, this is just enough to push you over the edge.
Thank you so much, Amina Taylor, correspondent in London, for that report. I'd like to welcome out of London now author and historian Marcus Papadopoulos. And out of Edinburgh, writer and political analyst John White.
Is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Well, thank you both for being with us to start this off. With Marcus out of London. I mean, Marcus, the government says the fuel crisis happened because there were not enough drivers to supply the service stations. But did the government not calculate this ahead of time? I mean, why was the situation allowed to reach such a critical point?
Well, I should first of all start by saying that, currently speaking, there is no energy crisis in the UK. Further to that, there is no food crisis either. Recently, I travelled from London to Pembrokeshire, stopping off at numerous places along the way. I saw no signs of an energy crisis. I saw no signs of food shortages in any of the supermarkets which I visited. It is certainly the case that a couple of weeks or so ago, people were stockpiling petrol or diesel, and that did cause a short-term problem. But the people who were stockpiling petrol or diesel did so on account of mainstream media outlets in the UK putting out completely uncorroborated, unsubstantiated stories saying that there will be a petrol crisis in Britain. I would also add as well that it is certainly the case that many of these aspects have been mismanaged by the current government. But then this is a problem that has been plaguing Britain for many years now. So we hear about how there will be in Britain this winter a rise in electricity and a rise in gas. But year in, year out, there is always a rise in energy prices in Britain.
So Marcus, are you saying this has been created? I'm sorry to interrupt you. So are you saying that this has been created by the media? And if so, why?
What I believe is that British mainstream media is depicting something in order to distract the British public from a lot of very serious problems at home. It is certainly the case that the British government has relied too extensively on liquefied natural gas. Also, the British government should have put politics aside and should have sat down with the Russian government and secured an energy deal with Russia, which would have resulted with an uninterrupted flow of Russian natural gas. But alas, the British wanted to put politics first, and as a result, if there is to be a shortage of gas this winter in Britain, that will be the fault of the British state, and the ordinary British man and woman will pay the price. And it goes back to what I said moments ago. There is always a rise in the UK every single year in the price of gas and electricity. Why? Because energy was privatised many years ago in Britain. Why is it that people in Russia do not struggle to pay their gas bills or their electricity bills? Why? Because electricity and gas has been state-run. It is not, electricity and gas does not exist in Russia to make a profit. It exists to provide people with electricity and gas. The same cannot be said, alas, in Britain.
Right,
electricity and gas is used by the British state to make money, like public services in Britain are used by the public state to make money.
All right, stay with me. I mean, because I think we're going to get into the whole, then we look at neoliberalism and what has happened in the West because of those policies. But let me get John in on this conversation. John, your take. You heard what Marcus said, that basically this has been something that has been exaggerated because basically there really isn't a crisis. What do you think?
There is a crisis. It's a global crisis. Excuse me, I'll just change position. The light's in the way here. It's a global crisis caused in large part by the surge in demand for fuel post-COVID by economies all over the world. But Brexit has exacerbated that crisis due to the supply chain issues created by Brexit. The just-in-time supply chain system adopted by the UK has broken down because the importation of vital supplies and basic necessities have been interrupted by increased custom controls and bureaucracy. So there is a multiplicity of crises, and the UK has been in the eye of a storm because of COVID, but also because of Brexit and all the problems that it has unleashed.
Okay, and hopefully we will establish that video connection right now. That was, of course, the voice that you could hear of John. Hopefully we'll establish a better connection. I mean, Marcus, you say that basically you had driven through the country and you went to various stores and you did not notice it. So tell me about when we have been seeing long lines at petrol stations. We have been shown shelves that have been half empty, and we've had people actually had interviews in the UK with individuals on the street that are complaining about the current situation. I mean, what do you say to this? Hasn't the country gone from crisis to crisis, or do you not see it that way?
Well, I must first of all clarify something. There is no global energy crisis. Such an argument is completely untenable. For example, there is no energy crisis in France. There is no energy crisis in Germany. There is no energy crisis in Italy. Indeed, there is no energy crisis anywhere in Europe. Why? Because Europe or the European Union and also individual countries which make up Europe have secured concrete agreements with Russia to receive an uninterrupted flow of gas. Those governments put their people first by wanting to ensure that their industries and domestic households would not be left without electricity or gas at any time of the year. Now, returning to the UK, yes, it is certainly the case that for a few days there was a shortage, and I have to use the word shortage in a very loose way, a shortage of petrol and diesel. Not because there was a lack of petrol or diesel in the UK. It was because British mainstream media was putting out stories, as I said moments ago, completely unsubstantiated stories, which caused panic. And as a result, people were stockpiling petrol and diesel. People were going to their local petrol stations. They were taking jerry cans with them. They were filling them up. And that was causing a short-term problem, but that only lasted for a few days. Furthermore, it is the case that in some areas of the UK, supermarkets were not bare, they were not empty, but there were certainly products which were not available. But that was only a few cases. However, British mainstream media has depicted a completely false picture by saying that the whole of the UK is experiencing a shortage of energy and a shortage of food. That is simply not the case. And I believe that part of the reason for this false portrayal is to distract the British people from some very worrying developments at home. And I'm specifically referring to these changes which the British state is imposing on the British people vis-a-vis what is known as COVID-19. But there are also many other problems in Britain. For example, there are 14 million people in Britain living in poverty. That includes 4 million children. 4 million children living below the breadline. Now, one of the tactics the British state has used over centuries to remain entrenched in power is to distract the average British man and woman from what is happening in their society.
Okay.
So, for instance, they will say that Russia is causing the energy crisis. They will say that Russia is a threat to the freedom and democracy of Britain, because they are distracting the British people from the terrible measures and the terrible problems which are plaguing the British people.
Okay, stay with me, Marcus. Let me get John back in on this. John, your take, you were shaking your head partially while Marcus was speaking. Your take on this, so go ahead.
This is not a crisis that's being fabricated by the British mainstream media. There is a material crisis. It's largely a result of the post-COVID demand for energy around the world, especially on the part of the Chinese and Indian economies. European countries are suffering fuel shortages, but not to the same extent as UK because of Brexit, and also because they have larger and better storage facilities. For example, under the May government, the largest storage facility in the UK that could hold gas reserves and fuel reserves for up to 3 months was shut down by Centrica, and now we only have the capacity to store fuel for 3 days. So that's had a material effect on the crisis. Gazprom is refusing to, or certainly up to now, has refused to go beyond the contract it agreed with the UK and other European territories for its supply. Putin recently voiced his opinion on the matter, saying that he will not let this crisis go to a certain point. He will look to increase production under Gazprom, which is a Russian state-owned energy giant. But there is a crisis globally because of the demand. COVID has accentuated that crisis. We have a crisis of haulage because of the shortage of HGV drivers, which is also part of the crisis because European drivers can't get into the UK as easily as they did under the EU. Northern Ireland is not suffering the same crisis because it still operates under the single market as part of the Northern Ireland protocol. So I do respectfully have to disagree with the thrust of Marcus's points on this matter.
Well, John, you feel that what you're calling these various crises, that it has been exacerbated by Brexit? Is that what you're saying?
Absolutely. There's no doubt about it. We have different customs arrangements with the EU. We're not part of the single market. We do no longer have frictionless trade. Boris Johnson lied when he said that his deal, his oven-ready deal, would still maintain frictionless trade. And so it's caused interruption in supply chains, and that has fed into a crisis. So as I said, there's a multiplicity of factors involved, but the issue is this: Brexit has only sown dragon's teeth. Rather than free us from the clutches of the dictatorship in Brussels, as its main drivers would have maintained, Nigel Farage and the right wing of the Tory party, it has only made Britain isolated. And it just confirms that Brexit is an entirely misplaced understanding of Britain's role in the world in the second decade of the 21st century. It is an emotional reach back in time to a supposed golden age when Britannia ruled the waves and the Union Jack flew whatever it damn well pleased. And guess what? You can't eat a flag. A flag doesn't eat a hole. It doesn't put food on the table. And this is a result of false consciousness.
Marcus, your thoughts on that? I mean, do you feel that the Brexit has played a role in all of this? Or do you feel that all of this is part of what you said, basically just trying to deflect some other problems, more serious problems that have taken place there?
Well, as I said moments ago, Britain has relied on liquefied natural gas, and Britain should have looked to Germany as an example of ensuring gas, an uninterrupted flow of gas for British industry and households by securing an agreement with Russia. And in the last few days, we have seen a most bizarre chapter with British mainstream media. Because first of all, British mainstream media outlets were running stories saying that Vladimir Putin to increase the supply of natural gas to Europe to avert a crisis. Then within 48 hours or so, the same media outlets were saying that Vladimir Putin is going to decrease the amount of natural gas to Europe to instigate a crisis. It really is preposterous nonsense. I also do not believe it any role in this. I believe that whilst I support Britain withdrawing from the European Union, the European Union is not a socialist entity. It is a neoliberal, culture-hating, religion-hating. It's inflicted horrific damage on the lives of working class people across the European Union. One need only visit countries in Central Europe such as Hungary and the Czech Republic, and in Eastern Europe such as Romania and Poland, to see how factories have been as a result of the European Union. But it is most certainly the case, and I've been saying this for many years, that Britain is a country plagued by many illnesses. And this has been the case for centuries. Why? Because the British state, different to the lives of the ordinary British man and woman, wherever they are in the Union, in England, in Scotland, in Wales, in Northern Ireland. They simply do not care. And when I say the British state, I mean the British establishment. For example, the royal family and the aristocracy. For instance, energy should not have been privatised. Electricity and gas should exist to ensure that people do not go cold in the autumn and winter months. Electricity should exist to provide people with lighting at any time of the year. But because the British state values money above all else, it privatised energy. And it is absolutely true that for decades now, not just since Brexit, for decades now, British people in the autumn and winter months have been fearful of putting on the heating because they are afraid they will not be able to pay their energy bills.
All right, let me get John in here because our time is running out quickly. But John, how is it that London still considers itself as Great Britain when it appears that it is getting more and more difficult for it to even keep millions of its people from simply freezing to death? I mean, it really does not sound like a first world country. Your thoughts?
Well, the British political establishment no longer runs an empire, but does operate under the illusions of an empire mind, and this is fed into Brexit. It has also managed to persuade a large swathe of working class people that the Union Jack is the way forward rather than class-based politics, which Marcus has eloquently laid out. I do entirely agree with the large part of the problem is not supply, it's ownership. Energy should be under state control. It's a necessity, it's a basic necessity. Privatisation has been an unmitigated disaster. But the entire Western world is going through the same crisis of late capitalism. But the British state's answer to that crisis, which 2008 global economic crash, has been to withdraw from the world, withdraw from reality, and lose itself in illusions of grandeur based on a misplaced understanding of the British Empire, a failure to address the real history of that empire. So this is a problem of a lack of understanding of Britain's role in the world, a lack of understanding of the empire, or the British obscurantism fed by myths surrounding the Second World War and Britain's role in the Second World War, and the demonization of Russia.
Okay.
Russia is the biggest country in Europe, and the idea that you can isolate Russia, that you can have a Europe that's going to be stable without Russia being included as a major partner.
And on that note, I'm so sorry I have to interrupt. Unfortunately, we are out of time. I appreciate both of you being with me on the Spotlight. Marcus Papadopoulos, author and historian out of London. John White, writer and political analyst out of Edinburgh. And as always, we appreciate you being with us on another Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashimi. Goodbye.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio.
This man changed the world.
Allahu Akbar, Khomeini Rahbar. Allahu Akbar, Khomeini Rahbar.
Our bosses couldn't cope with the idea of an 80-year-old Ayatollah, which they didn't even know what an Ayatollah was, who lived on garlic and onions and yogurt, directing a revolution that was about to topple America's most important ally.
We seek refuge in Allah from the accursed Satan. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of Allah, the Exalted, the Most Compassionate, the Most Merciful. Salam, hello, and welcome to our audience, and particularly a warm welcome to our program, The Man Who Changed the World. This is a program that is dedicated to the memory of Imam Khomeini. May God bless his great soul. And it's about his life and times. And once again, I'm joined by my good friend, Dr. Mahdi Tarabi, on the subject of Imam Khomeini's life and times. And I'd like to say salam and welcome him to the program.
Alaykum salam rahmatullah. Thank you for having me.
Thank you very much for giving us your valuable time. Sir, we are on the subject of leadership, and there's a growing lack of it in the West, mm-hmm. for some reason. Because, of course, you know, there's crisis upon crisis of what's happening in the West at the moment. So take us into the difference, really, between what happened here in 1979 and what's going on in the West since then.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. I think this is a very good subject to talk about, and it really sure. is one of those basic issues.
That it really is, yes.
That if we're able to correctly analyze it and collect and correctly and, you know, deeply try to understand it, it can really open the doors for a lot of other issues.
Absolutely.
It's the key that opens up a lot of the doors for other issues. Mm. And, you know, if we want to maybe... at the beginning, maybe give some headings like crisis of leadership in the West. You know, the supreme leader.
Yes.
You know, religious leadership.
Absolutely.
Walayat Faqih.
Yes.
Right? So these are things, you know, when we talk about having Walayat Faqih, mm. when we talk about having a Islamic scholar, a faqih, a person
a
who
jurist.
Is a jurist, a jurisprudent.
Yes.
Who is, you know, an expert mm-hmm. in laws,
yes.
being the leader of a society, of a nation, and, you know, this is versus other ways and other kinds of leadership.
Absolutely.
This is what we're talking about.
This is what
This is what a big part of the revolution was about.
Yes.
This is a big part of what when we're talking about governance in Islam. In the religion of Islam, according to Islam, in the time when the Prophet and the Imams are not physically present.
That's correct, yes.
You know, we're talking about, well, what kind of a leadership do you have?
Exactly.
Okay. And, of course, that's related to the larger issue of what kind of a political system you have.
Of course.
And you know, this is the beautiful thing that we can see in Iran, is that we have a situation where we have a very deep, complex... and a sophisticated political system in which we have, you know, elected officials on the local and on national level. We have a parliament. We have a independent judiciary.
Sure.
And an elected president, executive. And then above this whole system, which is, and the system being a way in which the people are participating in their lives, in their political life, in their social life, in their economic life, in the decision makings that affect them on top of this system as a person who is able to guide it, who's able to steer it in the right direction, who's able to prevent it from, you know, going to either extreme, we have a supreme leader.
Exactly.
And who, as you know, we were mentioning, is a religious person.
Exactly. And the fact is that the Constitution reflects that, doesn't it?
Exactly. And so this is something when we had, you know, as we've seen in history, we've had a person like, you know, Imam Khomeini.
Yes.
And after Imam, we have Ayatollah Khamenei, who's the leader. Yeah. Now, I'm saying all this, and what I'm trying to point out is that let's look at what the alternatives have been.
Yes, I mean...
And what effect this has had on the societies, on the politics.
Well, what we still have today in the Middle East, I mean, this is the real issue, isn't it?
But not only in the Middle East.
Yeah.
If we look at it, because we were talking about the crisis in the
West, but of course, you know,
right,
regionally,
exactly. You know, these are things that when you talk about it, that it's really, you know, I think if you put aside prejudice and if you put aside some of the, you know, brainwashing that people get in
the
West,
propaganda, basically.
And the propaganda,
yeah.
You will see that it has been to the benefit of Iran,
yes,
to have this kind of leadership.
To have a jurist in control.
To have a system of Walayat Faqih, yeah. It's been to the benefit. And I'm talking about benefit materially.
Yeah.
You know,
materially,
by those standards which, you know, politicians and politics and political systems and economic systems are measured.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely.
Okay.
That's a very, very
So this is the
point.
Point.
Yeah.
So putting that aside for a second, we can come back to that in terms of looking the positive side of it. Let's look at the negative side of it. I'm talking about the West now, for example, you have a system, and we've talked about this many times before in different programs, where, for example, in the States, in the United States, you have a leadership, you have an elite who is not capable of defending and pursuing the interests of the United States, of the people of the United States.
No, they're not. Yeah, that's right. Yes.
Whether it's the economic interests.
What happened to those three words that were so pronounced in the U.S. Constitution, we the people?
Right. And this is the point, which is that they pursue the elite interests.
Yes.
They pursue very narrow corporate interests.
Yes. And that's 0.1%.
Right.
It?
And then they come on TV and they're like, well, it's to your benefit.
It's so to your benefit.
So this is the difference. Mm.
They're they're dictating to
the
people.
And these are supposed to be the higher level, you know, statesmen, the president, you know.
Yeah.
Forget about the local guys. I mean, it's all about, you know, money and, you know, who has the most money and, you know, campaigning based on, you know, attack ads. And I mean, it's just completely dirty, you know.
Yes.
So we're talking, you know, we're not even talking about that aspect of it.
No.
Which is you know, forget about that.
Yes.
We're talking about leadership.
Leadership, yes.
We're talking
the
about
actual,
you know,
qualities that are required in an individual.
You know, we have a situation, and it wasn't always like this in the West.
No. They had statesmen.
Right. They had good leaders.
Yes.
You know, I always talk about De Gaulle in France.
In France, yes.
Being
yes,
an example
yes.
of a pretty good leader.
Yeah.
You know, for that society.
Yes.
Having moral courage, you know, standing up
for the French interests.
Right. And, you know, just basically being a person who...
A patriot.
Right, and being kind of selfless and not really trying to, you know, play politics in the
absolutely.
You know, this
this goes down well with the Scottish. You know.
Right.
We understand that concept
we,
very
we'll
well.
We'll see if we have to add Alex Salmon to that. But, but he seems to be doing a good job.
Yeah.
So, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, of course, De Gaulle having the war and, you know, liberation of France and so on.
But
I mean, so
you're quite right, sir, because
so
there weren't many good statesmen.
Right,
no,
and, you
no
know,
doubt,
people talk about Churchill, you know.
Churchill, yes.
We can argue that. I mean, I don't think he was really a good leader in the sense that during the war he, you know, he did what he had to do, which is to, you know, fight the war.
Yeah.
But other things, I think.
But he tops the poll as far as the
All I'm saying is
UK
that
is
in terms of being a leader during the war.
Yes, he was very effective.
But, you know, there are a lot of major things that were horrible about, you know, what he did.
Throughout his career. There was a lot of criminal things
including chemical weapons.
The chemical weapons used on Kurds, you know, which brings back memories of 1990.
Right.
Yeah.
So, you know. But the point I'm trying to make is that, you know, we really have a crisis in the West.
That's right.
In terms of leadership. We
moral
right.
And
right. I mean, if you look at the quality of, let's say, U.S. presidents.
Yes, yes.
You
why did it decline into towards the evolutionary
scale
of Darwinism? That instead of, you know, man evolving from apes, it went from man to ape.
Right. I mean, these are things that are, you know, it's a problem. Because, I mean, if you look at, I don't know, you know, if you want to look at it from a, you know, sympathetic perspective.
Yeah.
You know, you had people like Eisenhower. Okay, I mean,
yes, I mean, Dwight,
you know, we don't really like him here because he, you know, did the coup. But the point I'm trying to make is that,
but
you know,
he was a very effective.
But
president.
You know, in for U.S. standards, he was pretty good.
He was a very good statesman. Yes,
you know, or if you look at somebody like, you know, I would even say Nixon compared to some of the people that we have these days. You know, we're not talking about the domestic things.
Yeah,
but,
yeah, sure,
but internationally,
but,
you know, had a strategic,
Nixon went to China.
Right, started a strategic vision. You know, tried to end the Vietnam War. You know,
sure,
did a lot of things.
He lived up to some aspects.
Right.
Of
I mean, there was a feeling there that you felt like there was something beyond themselves.
Exactly.
There was something beyond just narrow, you know, special interests that
they were
pursuing.
That's very.
And
good,
a lot of them would even stand up to certain streams within their own party and within their own political movement in order to do what they thought was right for the country. So these are rare, and it just doesn't happen anymore.
No.
You know, if you just look across the board, if you look at one of these EU, you know, summits, or if you look at one of these, you know, G20 summits and whatever, I mean, how many of these people would you consider to be statesmen? How many of them would you consider to be moral leaders?
Exactly.
Because it's really about moral leadership.
Exactly. My question to you, Dr. Tarabi, is this. Is it deliberate?
Well, what I'm trying to say is that, you know, the whole idea of moral leadership is completely out the window in the West.
Yeah.
You know, we have this idea. The reason why we have